funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What will it take to protect U.S. troops and allies overseas from the devastating effects of improvised explosive devices? Although only about 10 to 15% of IEDs deployed by insurgents in Iraq and Afghanistan actually cause damage, the sheer number of these weapons makes them a significant threat. The Pentagon has put at least $60 billion into the fight against IEDs for robots, drones, remote surveillance and analysis, even a couple of blimps. So why are there still so many IEDs on the ground, and is our strategy to eliminate them somehow misguided? Andrew Coburn is a journalist who covers national affairs and defense. His article in the current issue of Harper's Magazine is called Search and Destroy, the Pentagon's Losing Battle Against IEDs. Andrew, welcome to Think.
Hi, well, great to be with you.
Let's start with this. Why do insurgents prefer IEDs to conventional explosives, things like landmines and hand grenades? Is this just about cost and about availability?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, the other way you can refer to them is homemade bombs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as anyone who's served in Afghanistan knows, these are really assembled from household items. The explosive is homemade, or at least can be locally made, basically from fertilizer, which is available across the border in Pakistan in great quantities. I mean, it's, you know, every farmer needs it, has it. They've tried to stop this particular fertilizer coming into Afghanistan without success. And then, you know, it's quite often that you'll find there's stuff they use, cooking pots, they use, you know, torch batteries, you know, just stuff you find around the house or certainly in any hardware store. So that's why an insurgent, especially in a very poor country like Afghanistan, would obviously go for this weapon.
And not only are IEDs cheap and relatively easy to fabricate in most cases, there is also very little risk involved in physically planting them.
Well, that's right. I mean, obviously, you know, a lot of people do get killed or, you know, captured or injured or wounded, insurgents, U.S. or NATO forces. But in terms of the overall number of bombs that are planted, I mean, tens of thousands, the number of people involved, actually, statistically, your chances of getting anything happening to you while you're planting a bomb are pretty close to zero.
On the other hand, IEDs have been responsible for fully two-thirds of U.S. casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan. And essentially, this non-standard technology is the standard weapon of insurgent groups.
Well, it is. It's paradoxical, isn't it? I mean, we've spent, as I say in my article, if you add everything in, including, you know, all the things that IEDs, or these bombs, have caused us to do, we've spent something around $70 billion trying to deal with, you know, bombs put together for a few dollars from cooking pots and, you know, the other things I described. So it's the low... It's the low technology item that's really come out ahead, and our response, as I describe, has been to go for more and more elaborate, you know, high tech answers. You know, the giant cameras high in the sky that beam images back to supercomputers back in this country to process the images that'll show. You know, it gets very elaborate and very expensive, of course, but as the, you know, relevant Army officials I talked to said, well, you know, the proportions haven't really changed.
So let's talk a little bit about the history of this, Andrew. The Pentagon has been experimenting with very expensive high-tech surveillance in guerrilla-controlled areas since the Vietnam War. Can you tell us a little bit about Operation Igloo White?
Yes. I describe Igloo White in the article because it was really the first attempt to automate an entire battlefield, and I think it demonstrates what the Pentagon's deepest desires are. This was during the people who don't remember, during the Vietnam War, you know, our big problem, or what was considered our biggest problem, was that the enemy, the North Vietnamese, could endlessly funnel supplies and equipment and reinforcements down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which was a whole series of trails through the jungle down from North Vietnam into South Vietnam. So naturally we wanted to stop this, and the solution, the very high-tech solution was a, what you, as you describe it, Project Operation Igloo White, and that consisted of tens of thousands of sensors, devices that would, you know, that would pick up sound or sense movement, or pick up the smell of ammonia, i.e., people urinating. And they would relay, whenever they picked up these signals, they would relay them back actually to aircraft that patrolled permanently overhead, which would then relay them back to a base in Thailand where there were IBM 360 computers, which were in those days the biggest, most powerful we had, which would process the sound and sort of figure out where it had come from, which sensors were relaying it, and therefore we'd know where the enemy were and we'd know how many, you know, trucks or, you know, men were marching past and where, and then we could send, you know, bombers to go and bomb them. And it all sounded great on paper, even if it did cost, I don't know, $5 or $6 billion. And the Pentagon and the Secretary of Defense had high hopes for it. It was known as the electronic fence, and it was a total bust. I mean, the enemy soon figured out what was going on, and they would simply move the sensors, or actually, I just heard someone wrote to me yesterday describing one thing they would do, which was they'd tether a herd of goats around these sensors that were detecting ammonia and sort of put for seismic trembling, and then we'd come along and bomb the goats, and then they'd run the convoy through. It's so it was a it really didn't work at all. It was a huge disaster. It was quietly folded by the Air Force when it turned out it didn't work. But that mindset that produced Igloo White is still with us today in our battle against the IEDs.
Yeah, tell us about the Air Force's Gorgon Stare program, which sounds as if it is a similar sort of boondoggle, but is being put into place at an even greater expense.
Absolutely. It's a very good example. Gorgon Stare is this idea that you can... you have it in it's a device mounted in, well, mostly in drones, Reaper drones, and they fly around above Afghanistan. And the idea is that they take a continual image of, I think it's a 20 square kilometer area, and they take 2 frames a second of this entire area, and then the first purpose is about down on the ground. You know, a U.S. unit can look at their at a screen and getting the images from Gorgon Stare, and they can say, "Oh, look what's happening!" You know, over the hill there's an ambush, or there's a guy over there, you know, 5 miles away laying an IED, and they'll know everything, you know, immediately.
It would be nice to know that, but it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. It's sort of, in a way, when you think about it, it can't work. I mean, it's for a start. You know, supposing someone's on the other side of a hill, you know, it's you know, they don't, it can't look through the hill. You know, it's looking, it's you know, it's capturing its images from a fixed point in the sky. And as a matter of fact, there was an operational test done last year by the Air Force, which reported back that this thing really didn't work. It wasn't going to be much use. Nevertheless, it was fun. It was fielded. It was sent to Afghanistan in April this year. And the industry, I'm just reading just before you called, the industry just gave it, it just received a big award for the speed for which it was deployed. So here we have a multi-billion dollar system, you know, which consumes not only huge amounts of money, but also lots of people to operate it, which doesn't work, which they knew wasn't going to work. And here they are giving themselves awards for sending it anyway.
Yeah, this is really unbelievable to me. So it was deemed operationally ineffective before it was actually deployed in the war zone. I mean, are the developers assuming it will fix itself somehow?
Sorry, can you say that again?
Are developers of Gorgon Stare assuming it might fix itself, or they might figure out how to fix it while it is deployed?
I don't know. They... the developers, it's principally a corporation called the Sierra Nevada Corporation, who are based in Nevada. They're extremely politically well-connected. They've given lots of money to Congress, which I'm sure is a t- total coincidence. And they go onwards to prosperity. You know, it's what can I say? It's unfortunate that, you know, meanwhile, down on the ground, we have young men and women who are, you know, at incredible danger, marching, you know, walking about the Afghan countryside, you know, suffering horrendous casualties, not just killed, but horrendous injuries. And this is where we put our efforts. You know, in it, you know, maybe we could talk in the piece, I contrast this with a very different approach.
Yeah, you write here about a Marine Master Sergeant, Tanos Chavez, who possesses this uncanny talent for finding and defusing IEDs. Can you tell us about the equipment that he, in fact, finds most critical in his work?
Yeah, I went to see Tanos Chavez. I should say he was deployed in the most lethal part of Afghanistan in 2008, a place called Sangin in Helmand Province. And he was, because I heard about him from, you know, other Marines who said this guy was amazing. He would, first of all, he was very good at putting himself in the minds of the other side, thinking, you know, oh, where would I put an IED? So he was very good at sort of spotting where you were likely to find one. And then he was very good at training people, you know, the other Marines, who were young Marines he was working with, you know, how to look for them and where to be on their guard. And then when they did find them, he was brilliant at defusing them. And I asked him, I said, well, I mean, I'd been hearing all about Gorgon Stare and all these wonderful things. I said, well, what technology did you find useful? And he pulled out a picture of himself holding up about 100 feet of parachute cord wrapped around a stick. He said this was the most useful tool I had, which he'd use it to pull bombs apart. You know, he'd tie one end to the bomb once he'd uncovered it and then walk 100 feet away and give it a good pull and pull it apart. I mean, he had a few other things too, wire clippers, a thing for sweeping, for a metal detector, and various kinds of explosive charges, which he'd used in different ways to sort of blow bits of the bomb apart when he needed to.
But essentially, it sounds like most of what he's using could be picked up in a hardware store around the corner.
Absolutely, I think that's exactly what he did. In fact, he said, and I said, well, what about technology? You know, and he said, technology will let you down every time when you need it the most. He didn't think much of that, you know, whiz bang stuff at all.
Yeah, he's been given access to those special robots that we saw in the Hurt Locker that are supposed to go in there in the place of human beings, and they don't actually work in many situations.
Well, they didn't. I mean, he said, apart from anything else, they didn't work for a very simple reason, which was where he was. It was in a compound. It was in Afghan terms quite a rich area, agricultural area, because they were doing so well out of the opium business. Everyone was growing opium, so there were a lot of everyone's living in sort of densely packed compounds, and the passages between the compounds are very narrow, and it was actually impossible to maneuver a robot down through those narrow passages. And anyway, he said they always broke down. We all remember the Hurt Locker movie, which was about someone like him. And I said, well, you know, did you wear one of those big bomb suits to, you know, bomb-proof suits like they do in the Hurt Locker? He looked at me like I was mad. He said, what, in 110-degree heat?
Andrew Coburn is here. He's a journalist who covers national affairs and defense. He's got a story in this month's issue of Harper's Magazine called Search and Destroy, the Pentagon's Losing Battle Against IEDs. You can join our conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Andrew Coburn. He covers national affairs and defense on a regular basis and has an article in the November issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called Search and Destroy, the Pentagon's Losing Battle Against IEDs. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think at kera.org. So in addition to the Gorgon Stare program, we have other things working as well. How is Gotcha radar supposed to work, Andrew?
Doppler radar. It's a, you know, it's, again, all these things, you know, they can be useful, but they, Gotcha radar.
Gotcha.
They, again, that's another sort of dream, you know, basically a defense contractor dream, but also in the minds of the high technology loving Air Force, which is, again, that you'll be able to see, their boast was they could see something on the ground as small as a cockroach, which I think is obviously a fantasy from high up. And then they'll be able to, you take a picture of everything that's going on, and so and then you store all the pictures in a computer back here. I mean, everything is beamed back using extraordinary amounts of bandwidth, by the way. So that then, you know, a bomb goes off. Okay, you have a, you look back at all your pictures of that location and you see some particular Afghan, you know, yesterday or last night digging a hole there. Then you look at all the pictures, you follow him back through your pictorial record to where he lives. And then you can send a, you know, a special forces team to go and kill or capture him. That's the theory. But again, you know, it's first of all, this requires enormous amounts of processing power, and they've been trying this for years. I mean, five, six years ago in Iraq, and it never really worked. I mean, they claimed, you see great claims for it working, but you know, it turns out you get the wrong guy who's just been looking at the hole in the road, or there's so many things that can go wrong. But, you know, like Gotcha Radar, like another one called Blue Devils, Gorgon Stare. I can't remember, there's like dozens of them by now. You know, they've generated billions of dollars into the procurement system here, but they haven't really done a lot for, you know, for saving lives at the other end.
Well, let's talk about those billions, because I think people understand that, you know, in developing certain technologies, some will work, some will not work. But a lot of this money is being spent, and essentially the Pentagon is being handed money that it can give to contractors, and there is no requirement of congressional oversight?
Well, there's a requirement of congressional oversight, but like, you know, the Gorgon Stare contract wasn't put up, for example, was a sole source contract, so far as I know. The excuse has been, and it sounds very reasonable when you hear it, I mean, certainly when the Congress heard it, said, hey, our men and women are dying out there. We've got to, we can't go through this endless bureaucracy that we normally have to undertake for military procurement. We've got to get the stuff there now. And so that way, they were able to cut a lot of corners in getting equipment into the field, which, again, you know, sounds reasonable, is reasonable in a way. I mean, you want to get stuff. If people need the stuff, you need the equipment, you want to get it there quick. But it also enables them, you know, human nature being what it is, to people to cut a lot of corners in other ways and, you know, hand out contracts to their friends. There's been a lot of that going on, to send stuff that's not been properly tested, a lot of that gone on, and to send stuff that, you know, has been tested and doesn't work, like Gorgon Stare we were talking about earlier. So you know, it's, I can't really, you know, I don't say that people should, you know, go to jail or anything for this. It's really a fault of the system. When you have a system that's really, that's geared to generating dollars, I mean, to generating contracts, and which is what it is in the end, maybe either, you know, it's the way it's turned out, you're unlikely to get, you know, something, you know, the, really the best stuff for the fighting, you know, the men and women deployed at the other end. That's why I tell the story of Tanos Chavez and, you know, what the Taliban tried to do about him because that's, you know, on the one hand you have high tech and complexity and dollars. On the other hand, you have one guy from Tillamook, Oregon, you know, with his, you know, his roll of cord and his wire clippers, who actually cleared an entire town.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Raman in Highland Village. Hi, Raman.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I had a question for your guest. I heard an interview a while back, the fact that they had actually seen evidence that most of the IUDs were built in Iran by the Islamic government and Hezbollah, and were actually sent to Iraq and Afghanistan. I was wondering if your guest had heard also the same report. I take my answer offline. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. What do you know about that, Andrew?
That's been suggested. I think that's, well, it's really not the case. I mean, the whole point about the IEDs is that they are homemade. You don't need, you know, a big, you know, deployment system. And think about it. If they were all being made in Iran, then there'd have to be a whole logistics train of, you know, bringing these, bringing the devices in. You know, it's really the idea behind the suggestion, I mean, not by your caller, but because this is being said by the, you know, officials as well, is, you know, maybe they have a system like ours, you know, with a big big procurement system in Iran, buying the bombs, and then a big deployment system, shipping the bombs in, and a distribution system. But it's not like that, and that's our problem. I mean, if you see these things, as I have, I mean, the most elaborate piece of equipment is a 9-volt battery. The explosive is made, you know, in the Pakistani fertilizer factories. There's a big one called Pakarab, which is, you know, supplying every farm in Pakistan, but also supplying every smuggler who smuggles it across the border into Afghanistan. I will say, in response to your caller, maybe what you might be thinking of, there was a type of bomb that has turned up, to my knowledge, it hasn't been seen that much in Afghanistan, but was used, a very devastating effect in Iraq, which is a particular kind of homemade bomb called an EFP, explosively formed projectile, which was really like making a sort of, it was a way of sending a charge of super hot metal. I mean, I won't try and give the technical description on the air, but and it was very effective against our armored vehicles in Iraq, and it was used exclusively by the Shiite militias who were being supplied, certainly by Iran, and it was, they were, bits of those were come, not the actual total bombs, but some of the components were being brought in from Iran, although they could just as easily, they were also being made in Iraq. I mean, the essential principle that these were pretty easy to make, you know, remains the same. So you didn't need a complicated system.
So as we have all these multi-billion-dollar systems created by contractors failing our troops on the ground, you have the brilliance of a guy like Thanos Chavez, who essentially acts almost like a forensic psychologist, you know, in getting inside the heads of the people who are planting these things. How scalable are his abilities? I mean, can he teach what he knows, or is it sort of a gift that he's operating with?
I didn't quite hear you, Chrissy. How easy is it to sort of
pass on his
knowledge?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, well, I mean, it's, you know, there are very, obviously, he, in some ways, he was a unique character. On the other hand, people, I mean, they could be, if you put an emphasis on his using his smarts and the kind of smarts he deployed, and put the emphasis on the training, the training that he could give, then I think we'd do a lot better. I mean, they play lip service to this. They say, oh, yes, training the troops, that's what we do, and they have gotten better at it. Excuse me, they've gotten better at, you know, teaching soldiers and Marines before they go to Afghanistan what to expect. But the emphasis isn't on that, I would argue. And, you know, he, And people, I mean, I know from people who served with him in Afghanistan, they said, oh, he was able to teach us so much, you know, teaching the troops, teaching the Marines, other Marines, you know, he was 38, and these, you know, most of the Marines whose lives he was saving were in the, you know, 1920, teaching them what to look for, teaching them, you know, when you're going around the corner of a building, that's where they're likely to put a bomb, so, you know, jump that extra yard, or stuff like that. So it is, you know, the human element is always, more important than the technical element, and that's the priority we need to set.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Ian on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Ian.
Oh, afternoon. Yes, I was just wondering, as you know, the British Army, had to deal with very similar situation in Northern Ireland for, 30 years? I was wondering if the U.S. military had ever been able to ask the British military people from their experience how to deal best with these things. I don't think we used great technology like you were using.
Andrew, good source of advice there?
Sorry, Chris, that was slightly faint.
Ian was asking about, you know, with the problems that the British Army dealt with the IRA for years and years, and them having used a lot of IEDs or something similar, homemade bombs. Has the U.S. military consulted with the British military about what they learned in fighting the IRA?
Oh, for sure. In fact, the word term IED actually comes from Northern Ireland. It was the first coined by the British in Northern Ireland, improvised electronic device, explosive device. And of course, the British served, you know, in Helmand, the British served alongside the Marines in Afghanistan. In fact, there was a British unit in the town where Chavez was serving. There's been a lot of consultation back and forth. That being said, of course, the two wars, if you like, are very different. I mean, just in terms of sheer quantity, the Afghanistan and Iraq before it absolutely dwarfed what the British had to face in Northern Ireland. But the essentials are the same. I mean, the British had their, you know, different techniques, and I've talked to both the British people and to Chavez and fellow Marine EODs about this. You know, there was different, you know, just like every army does things in a different way. They consulted, but it was different. I mean, I tell in the article how the British used much, now we're doing it too, but the British were very, put a priority on using dogs. And in fact, Chavez was very fond of it. The British unit there had a dog, Trio. It was a small Labrador, who was good at finding bombs. So he found a lot. He helped find a lot of the bombs that Chavez defused.
So we've talked about the economics of this in terms of U.S. military defense contractors who are raking in billions of dollars to create these systems that seem not to function the way they are promised to function. Let's talk about the economics on the Afghan side. One source that you quote estimated that the fabrication and deployment of IEDs keeps 15,000 Afghanis employed, at least some of whom might have no ideological desire to be insurgents but need the work.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's... you know, an insurgency is, there's a very brilliant intelligence analyst I quote in the piece, Rex Ravolo, who really formulated this whole theory about how an insurgency is an economic activity. And you saw this in Sangin, where Chavez was. When Chavez and his fellow Marines arrived in the town, which was... in May 2008, I think it was, they were still gathering in the opium harvest. Everyone was hard at work bringing in the opium. And in fact, there was a local ceasefire. The farmers had asked the Taliban to declare a ceasefire which the Taliban were happy to agree to, because all the Taliban, a lot of the Taliban fighters, their rank and file, were all working, bringing in the opium harvest. That was, the employment that was going on then. Then, after a few weeks, the opium's all in, and now those people all got jobs fighting for the Taliban. which was the only other form of employment going in the area. Or, you know, and if not fighting for the Taliban, then planting bombs. And or even, you know, if they were had those sort of skills, making bombs. And so it's, you know, you don't necessarily, it isn't necessarily ideological. If the only job going is fighting for the insurgency or, you know, in one way or another, be it, you know, shooting a rifle or making a bomb or planting a bomb, then that's what people will do.
Back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. This time we have on the line Tate in Dallas. Hi, Tate.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
The comment that I had is if your guest could comment on the sense of frustration, regardless of the effectiveness of these technologies and methods, the frustration regarding the feeling of being hamstrung under current rules of engagement. You can be at a forward operating base looking at a video feed of people planting IEDs, but you're unable to attack for sometimes hours. Sometimes they complete their job and go back home because you're not able to fire on them, even though you might have artillery or air assets zeroed in on them the whole time. You're unable to do anything about it. And then an EOD team has to go risk their lives to take care of the IED. I was wondering if your guests could comment on that.
Well, we're going to go into a break here, and it's something that does not come up in the piece, but is it something, that Andrew, that you want to address when we come back from the break?
Sure. Actually, I saw there was a plane going overhead here, and I'm not sure I caught the entire question.
No problem. I can rephrase for you in just a minute. Basically, he was asking about the frustration based on rules of engagement where there are people at FOBs watching insurgents planting IEDs, and then they, because of the rules of engagement, they can't fire on them.
Okay.
So let's take a quick break here. The telephone number, if you'd like to join us, is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Back in a minute with Andrew Coburn, whose article in the current Harper's Magazine is called Search and Destroy, the Pentagon's Losing Battle Against IEDs.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Andrew Coburn. He has a story in this month's issue of Harper's Magazine called Search and Destroy, the Pentagon's Losing Battle Against IEDs. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372. And back to the question we had before the break, Andrew, have you seen troops who are frustrated by their attempts to stop people who are placing these IEDs being thwarted by rules of engagement?
Well, you know, that's a complaint. I don't know. Well, I've heard that. I don't know. The rules of engagement, I think if you know that someone's planting an IED, you're usually allowed to shoot them. I mean, obviously the restrictions, which would be frustrating, are in place because for obvious reasons, you don't want to see too many Afghan civilians gunned down whose relatives will then, I mean, who are not planting IEDs, because accidents will happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see that. I mean, I really haven't heard from people in the field that that's the major problem. I mean, yeah, it's very frustrating when you know someone's trying, you know, doing something designed to kill you and you can't get them when you have the chance, when that happens. But I'd say compared to the other problems we have out there, that's not the major one.
So in theory, Andrew, it would seem as if seeking out high-value targets, the guys who are building and placing the most IEDs or the most effective IEDs, could be a solution. But in practice, folks have found that IED attacks tend to rise in the aftermath of the death of one of these high-value targets. Can you talk about that?
Yes, sure. I mean, it's you know, our principal strategy really since the beginning has been to, you know, try and figure out who is leading these IED attacks. You know, every IED, they tend to happen the same way, both in Afghanistan and Iraq. You'll have an IED network, which will be someone in charge, and then he'll have, you know, bomb makers working for him who each have to supply so and so many bombs a week or a month, and then there'll be bomb planters, who people who go and put it and figure out where to plant it, and then trigger men, who are the ones who actually, you know, assuming that it's an active one where you have to press a button or something to let it off, trigger men who will detonate it. And our idea has been since the beginning of the Iraq war, has been to find the leaders, the key guys in the IED networks, and get rid of them by killing them. And then, you know, that really slows down the effort. And in fact, what I quote in the article was the only time, so far as I know, where anyone's really looked at cause and effect in this strategy, which was to take, it was an intelligence group in Baghdad did this, it was secret at the time, they took 200 cases where we had eliminated, you know, a high-value target, a high-value person in the IED networks, and then looked to see what happened afterwards, within the next day, 2 days later, 4 days later, a week later, you know, 3 kilometers away, 10 kilometers away, and so forth. And they found, and you know, very clearly, that the number of IEDs in the neighborhood went up. I mean, the figure I cite, you can, you know, the graph, as I'm told, goes up very sharply, then tapers off. But within a week later, a week after one of these high-value target missions, the number of IEDs in the neighborhood was up by 20%. I mean, which is within 5 kilometers, which is really a pretty startling indictment of the policy. And you think, why? How can that be? And actually, the answer is pretty obvious when you think about it, which is, it turns out that when someone is key guy is killed, he's replaced immediately. There's always someone like a number two who's waiting to step into his sandals and
prove himself because he's the new guy.
And this new guy wants to needs to prove himself. Maybe the old guy was getting a bit slack, a bit lazy. You know, the new guy has to show that, hey, I'm the right man for the job. Hmm. This is what seems to happen. So he says, hey, guys, you know, hey, to the troops, let's plant more IEDs. Maybe we need to avenge our late leader or whatever reason. But the numbers do go up. So, and in Afghanistan, where we've been pursuing this policy with much greater intensity even than we did in Iraq, it doesn't seem to have worked because, you know, the insurgency gets worse, gets stronger. And secondly, what I've heard from a lot of people in Afghanistan, I mean, on the U.S. side, is that what we have killed lots of Taliban, but they have been replaced, and the ones we get now are more extreme, more vicious, more irreconcilable than the ones we got rid of.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. This time on the line we have Harry in East Texas. Hi, Harry. Hello, Harry. Are you with us?
Chris, are you talking to me?
Yes, Harry. Go right ahead, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Gary. What I was wanting to know, and maybe it's a statement more than a question, but the technology was there last century with the tanks or the B-9s or whatever, and they had long extensions with a roller about 15 yards with big, heavy chains that were, and you'd raise the roller up, and the chains would wrap, and the company, or the battalion, not a battalion, the company would be behind, and they would be just tearing the dirt up. And the IEDs are no more than maybe a foot in the ground. And that was something that I hadn't heard, and it might be redundant. Maybe I did hear it, but I don't understand why they don't use that technology. And plus, the drones, why can't they use the drones at night for heat-seeking people that are actually burying these things?
Well,
I mean, it seems like it's so simple, and people are, what did I hear, 71 million or something like that? I mean, my God, revert back. You know, history follows itself.
Well, let's get some answers to that, starting with the issue, Andrew, of whether or not we should go back and consider using bulldozers to cover these things and detonating them that way as they did in World War II.
Well, we do. We have. There's a very, very big program to use rollers, like your caller suggested, you know, in front of vehicles. It can work, but the only problem is that, you can design that to set off pressure, the mines that are set to go when someone steps on them, when there's, a weight on them.
Mm-hmm.
But a roller, you can set it so that a roller won't do it, but a footfall will. It also means, it's confined to the roads. All you have to do is fuse the detonation part of the bomb to the side of the road where the roller won't go. You know, there's usually a very simple answer to these, like they use drones at night. But I just want to go back to the high-value target business, which is something I talk about. I give an example in the piece, in the article, which is, and it concerns Tanas Chavez, which
mm-hmm.
is that the Taliban, they got so disgusted that this guy, this one man, was ruining their whole campaign because he was finding all the bombs in the town and defusing them, that they set out to get him, and they brought in a specialist bomb maker to make a bomb that when he tried to defuse it would go off and kill him. And he found the bomb. I mean, it was put so he would find it. He took him a while, but he figured out what it was, that this was a booby-trapped. He defeated it. He was able to defuse it in a way that didn't blow up and kill him. And then a week later, there was another, and he defused with an extra wrinkle, designed to get him, and he defeated that, and the week after another, and the week after another. So there's this duel going on between him and the bomb maker, and the whole town was watching. I told the story in the article. Finally, a Marine sniper team, killed the bomb maker. I mean, they didn't know he was the bomb maker, but they was in a firefight, and they and they did kill a guy who turned out to be this special bomb maker. So, okay, victory. We killed the high-value target. Now we're okay. 2 weeks later, Chavez is called to another bomb, which was they were waiting for him. There'd been other Americans around it, but no one, it hadn't gone off. Someone was waiting at the other end of a long wire. When Chavez showed up, they let it off. He was crawling towards it. Because he was low down the ground, he vanished in a cloud of smoke, but he survived, but he was badly injured and really hasn't been able to, do his job since.
Mm.
But so that's what happens when you get a high-value target.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next on the phones with Philip in Frisco. Hello, Philip.
Hello. Hi. I just had a comment and I also had a question. I served in Afghanistan about this time 10 years ago. And I actually was in Sangin and was in Helmand, so I'm always pleased to hear, the latest reports coming out of it. Obviously, wasn't there in 2008, but my main comment was when we were over there, we not only just saw a lot of IEDs, but we also saw quite a number of foreign munitions. So I wanted to ask him if he was still seeing that kind of, not from Iran, but, from China, from other former Soviet socialist republics where... And I'll give you an example. I mean, we were seeing mines from Czechoslovakia, from East Germany, from China, from Russia, from everywhere. So just wanted to ask if he was still seeing that over there at this time.
Thanks for your call.
Yes, I mean, that's certainly true. I think the gentleman said he was there...
10 years ago.
10 years ago, yes. I mean, there are more. A lot of those have been sort of used up now. That's why you get more and more of these, homemade explosive type bombs. But I was just looking at a report yesterday from a place very near Sangin, where the foreign for the coalition troops that are there are actually using an old Soviet minefield that was left over from when the Soviets were there as part of their defensive perimeter. So there's, you know, this country has been so fought over for the last 30 years. It's, you know, it's like neck deep in, you know, in weapons and shells and mines and explosives. And yeah, your caller is absolutely right. There have been a lot of foreign munitions there now, but they seem to, of the mines, there seem to be less because, you know, they've been, so many of them have been used. And that's why, you know, I was emphasizing the homemade aspect of it all.
Andrew, you close the piece with this. Tomas Chavez was awarded the Bronze Star with Valor, but he was denied another medal, the Legion of Merit with Honor. Talk about why you think that was the case.
Well, yes, he was recommended. His commanding officer, the Marine commander, was so impressed with what Chavez had done, both in terms of, you know, the mines he'd cleared and also the way he sort of taught everyone to deal with them, that he figured he'd really changed the whole shape of the battle in that part of Afghanistan. I mean, he'd made not just a personal difference, but a sort of, you know, on the whole battlefront. So he'd recommended him for the Legion of Merit with Valor, which is traditionally given or customarily given to someone who's changed the whole, you know, the whole battle. And that means it normally goes to sort of lieutenant colonels, people, you know, in a commanding position, not to master sergeants. So when this got up the chain of command, this recommendation, someone took a look and said, we're not giving that kind of award to a master sergeant, and we'll give him a, you know, we'll give him a Bronze Star, you know, with a Valor, with V. And that was it. His commander was very upset about this, so that's why I bring it up. You know, he felt that here was someone who'd really made a big difference, you know, affecting hundreds, if not thousands of people, at least for a while. And, you know, he was denied the recognition he deserved. The British, meanwhile, gave the dog their the medal they have, which is the animal equivalent to the Victoria Cross.
Do you think that the denial of that Legion of Merit award also had to do with the fact that you know, Chavez's methods are very low tech and they don't necessarily justify the expenditures of $60 billion?
I can't say that for sure, but I would say that that's, you know, that's the Chavez approach is not a popular one. I mean, not he's unpopular, but that idea that, you know, as I say in the piece, or as someone says to me, guts and smarts, which is what Chavez has, you know, which he used to sort of to clear a town, is not what we emphasize. That's not the way the official machine wants to do things. They want Gorgon stare, you know, some, you know, multi-billion-dollar contract, high-tech eyes in the skies, you know, everything automated and things, which unfortunately doesn't work. So, yeah, I'm sure if Tomas Chavez had invented Gorgon stare, they'd be showering medals on him.
Andrew Coburn is a journalist who covers national affairs and defense. His article in the current issue of Harper's Magazine is called Search and Destroy, the Pentagon's Losing Battle Against IEDs. Andrew, thank you so much for spending this hour with
us. Hey, Chris, thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.